on it later.
Blog Talk Radio.
This land is mine. God gave this land to me. This brave and ancient land to me. And when the morning sun reveals her hills and plains, then I see a land where children can run free. So take my hand and walk this land with me, and walk this lovely land with me. Though I am just a man, when you are by my side, with the help of God, I know I can be.
Well, good evening. Welcome to Yada Yada Radio. My pleasure to be with you on this Shabbat along with JB and Kirk. We get to begin a new volume this evening. That was the intent of a program a couple of weeks ago, and we had the opportunity to learn from JB in this particular case, but it was really from Kirk on his analysis of some interesting Greek translations of what Yosha had to say as they were reconsidered into Hebrew. Now we're going to jump back into Yosha. For those who have listened to us all the way along, you'll know that we took a considerable detour as a result of a very simple word, one of the most common of all Hebrew words. A Hebrew word so common, most people don't even bother to translate it. It was henna. Henna is a similar word to Yahweh and Haya, the basis of Yahweh's name, and that it has two hays. In this case, an N in the middle, a nun. So hey, nun, hey. It's two people. In this case, I'm convinced that they are the two people who Henna is used to introduce Abraham and Sarah. Mm-hmm. And in the midst between them is a child, none, represented by the sperm. So two people standing up, reaching up to God with the second hey, denoted feminine. So that would be Sarah, the first Abraham. With a nun, a child, represented by the sperm in the middle. And we devoted chapter upon chapter to considering most everywhere that Yahweh had used henna in the opening story of the Torah. And it led us to some amazing things. We learned a great deal about the creation account, the rise of political and military and religious malfeasance in Babel, the flood, and of course a great deal more about the covenant, its terms and conditions, and also the tests that Yahweh has put in place so that he may ascertain those who are genuine and those who are pretenders as it relates to being adopted into his family. And that all brings us to a stark realization as we reprise Yashaya 3:1 through 3:4. The opening statement of the third chapter of Yashaya. And in it, we found Yahweh reaffirming something that he has made abundantly clear, which is that He is issuing an unrelenting indictment against his people, especially their propensity to be religious. And as we move forward, God is going to further distance himself from all human institutions, lambasting government and military leaders. It's a wake-up call for those who are patriotic and for those who have placed their faith in faith. The prophet's witness destroys the concept of an all-loving God. It renders the notion that God wants to be worshipped or that he blesses nations preposterous. Yahweh cannot be cajoled into responding to religious prayers. He despises them. He cannot be persuaded into accommodating the needs of believers and has no interest in saving them. He's an abject opposition to political correctness, multiculturalism, and tolerance. These religious and nationalistic concepts are delusional. Misled and manipulated by immoral and self-serving religious men and women. Those who believe them are played for fools. In reality, they have no one to blame for themselves because Yahweh has clearly and unambiguously rebuked man's most popular approaches and acclaimed solutions. He has done so within a prophetic text that is irrefutable. There are billions of copies of Yeshayah Isaiah available, and they are translated into most every language. Not only has the entire text been preserved in the great Isaiah scroll dating back 2,200 years, the prophetic promises contained within it prove beyond any doubt that the words we have been reading, words which indict and condemn religion and politics and patriotism and militarism, were authored by the Creator himself. In the previous two chapters, we came to understand, as I began, the implications of Hannah as it arose in Yeshayah 3:1. There, we were compelled to understand why God used it, this word that means look up, pay attention, examine the details, stand up above the crowd and consider the very nature of life itself. And he said, after using this word in the context of this word, that he had withdrawn the provision to support life. So as we move forward, the opening statement of the third chapter of Yeshayah will be reconsidered simply to provide the proper context for what follows. We've gone over this text in detail, so we're just going to summarize it this evening before we move on. God is explaining why he can no longer save his people. Indeed, he writes, behold, Hannah, the upright pillar of the tabernacle, Edom, Yahweh, of the spiritual implements, Saba, of the command and control regime of heavenly envoys, is rejecting and removing from Jerusalem the source from which teaching and guidance regarding reconciliation flow, and from Yahudah relates to Yah, related to Yah, and Yah was beloved. The support which upholds life, Meshen, the supportive pole which holds someone and something up, the basic provisions needed for life. The provisions extended by the shepherd's staff. All stores of bread and all supplies of water. Kirk, I know you did something because you told me before the show began. as it relates to the most controversial word in this list, which the religious would have translated Adonai.
Right.
My Lord or my Master. But that's not how the word is introduced or used in the Torah, which is the basis of Yahweh's teaching. He directs us to an entirely different meaning for this word and a different pronunciation of it, which was Edon.
Right.
That's what I found when I studied the word and Yahweh's usage of it. That when he uses it, he's using it in the Torah to describe the upright pillar in the center of the tabernacle of the witness that is used to hold it up, to secure it, to enlarge it, and nothing else.
Yeah. Well,
what did you find?
You know, where I go is obviously is an upright pillar of the tabernacle. And is defined as a foundation of a column or a pillar as a support for a structure, including a home, the upright pole in the tent of a in a tent, rather, is things.
Mm-hmm.
They were living in tents. And then if you looked at the letters, it's quite obvious you're talking about someone leading the authority leading you through a through the Pesach door. That's all pretty straightforward. And then Yahweh's, by association, the pillar of smoke I thought about is that led them through the wilderness. So every time you see Yahweh, and he's equated with this word, or when he couldn't be equated with Adonai, it's always an upright pillar. It's always something that sustains a stable position in the ground. And, you know, I think you've been there where the upright pole that was used to crucify Yahusha was placed in a socket in the ground, which is also part of the Edon's translation or in the lexicons and all. So everything you can find on Edon describes what Yahweh's always, the way he's always describing himself. We know that it cannot be Adonai. We know something's afoot there because everywhere you go for Adonai, you'll find the word Lord. Even in Yeshua, which I found this week, it's 26:13. It says, you know, there's a little quote in there where, in the English version, where other masters that rule over the family, and they use for the masters is plural for Adonai, Adonim. And then even for the word rule is Baal. Baal being, of course, Lord. So everywhere you go for Adonai, you have Baal, you have Lord, and everywhere we go, when we look up, and when we're talking about Baal, you wind up in it's always Lord, a master, someone who is out to rule over you.
Control, to possess.
Control, yeah. And there's just no way to equate that. Number one, he's already declared that he cannot be with other gods, and that's the title for Baal. So, you know,
the correct version of it. Such profound teaching. Yahweh introduces the concept, you know, as it relates to the upright pillar of the tent of the eternal witness, the tent of the restoring testimony. The Edon is introduced as that upright pillar, mm-hmm, which holds it in place, which raises the roof, which enlarges the building, which makes it secure. It's the center, the very core of the tent of the eternal and restoring witness. Well, that's a pretty good clue.
Yeah.
Right in the center of it. Without which there is no tent.
Well, if
and
you just look at
it, also introduces it as that pillar of light and the pillar of cloud by day and the pillar of light by night, in which Yahweh appeared to lead his children away from, out of, the bondage of human religious and political institutions, out of militarism and Mitzrayim, the crucibles of human oppression. And we should, as you mentioned, we should always be cognizant that Yahweh is really astute when it comes to the details. The more you look, the more you learn. And while the Christian cross is a holy pagan implement associated with Tammuz, the Ankh, the symbol of life in the Egyptian religion, when Taurus the bull, which was synonymous with the pagan gods of old, crossed the constellation of Taurus during the day where days and nights are of equal length on the spring equinox. But there is a detail not to be missed, which is that the actual implement upon which Yosha was placed was an upright pillar. In fact, even the Greek word that is used to describe it means, charu means upright pillar. It wasn't changed across until the Roman Catholic Church decided that that implement, that pagan idolatrous symbol would be the symbol of their religion. They wanted a dead god on the stick. The crucifix. Dead god on a stick. A goddamn religion. That's when they changed it to crux, or cross. Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years later. But the actual implement was an upright pillar. It was placed into a recess that was carved into the limestone. And that upright pillar was never lifted out. This idea of picking up a cross and burying it is stupid. It's not what happened. The only part of it that is removed is the horizontal bar, representing the lintel of the doorway to life. And it's not nailed to the upright beam. They're not going to waste metal in such a fashion. They're not going to tear up that upright pillar that where wood is so precious to them. The wood they were using was of olives, and it was so rare and so precious at the time. That upright pillar for the Romans was essential. They weren't going to destroy it by nailing iron and nails into it and then trying to pry those nails out and reuse them again. No, that upright piece was simply set on top of the upright pillar. A person hung there to die. So the actual implement of death is an idol. So, right, in a sense, that is the doorway to life. When Yahweh is saying that I'm withdrawing for the doorway to life, he's not going to miss a detail here, and the detail is idol. But if you're one of these religious, whores, pretending to translate God's word and doing so for monetary gain and rendering it Lord, it's despicable. You've lost all of it.
Yeah.
How are you going to understand what God's trying to say if you can't render the words consistent with the way God himself uses them?
Well, even just look at the word, and you do the same thing as I do. Yeah, you always look to the root of a word. So, yeah, what
right.
word was it derived from? And you can always
right.
see how a word was derived from one word. Yeah, the root word
right.
for Edom is Eden, which means a pedestal, base, or a socket. The only
right.
change in the letters is the addition of a wa, the tent peg. So you can easily see how that, a upright pole that would have been stuck in this socket and to enlarge the tent and secure the tent would have been derived from that. There is no way
right.
you can derive pedestal, base, or socket. You cannot get lord or master or owner or anything from that. There's no link. There's nothing even remotely linking these two concepts together. So how on earth could you say that lord was derived from this pedestal, base?
And you know who's responsible for that?
Well,
it makes no sense, but I'll tell you who's responsible for it. The Masoretes.
Rabbis?
Oh,
yep. Yeah, the Masoretes, the rabbis. Because the word is clearly Edom, and it was diacritically marked by the Masoretes to read Adol. Mm-hmm. And then Adonai, my Lord. You know, Adol and Adonis, same root, same name.
Right.
The pagan god. Do you think that the queen of the universe is going to use a title of a Greek god, Adonis?
No.
They'll have no other gods before me or in my presence. I don't think so.
I don't think so. It's Edom. So indeed, behold, the upright pillar of the tabernacle, Yahweh, of the spiritual implements is rejecting and removing pure, taking away. From, there's two places that matter to God. And if he's taking away the support for life from these two places, then I'm telling you, at that point it only exists in one place.
Sure.
If he's taking it away from Jerusalem and Yehudah, it's not in Mecca. It ain't in Washington, D.C. It isn't in Europe or the Americas. If he's taking it away from those two places, the two places most important to him, and there's only one place where it remains, the Torah.
Mm-hmm. Yes, doesn't that answer the question, though, that we were asking, like, why there's so few people between 750 BCE and today that... Did he say right here he's taking it all away? There's no place where he's giving it back.
Correct.
He showed up, but he didn't come to correct this. He came to do, he did Pesach, Masa, and Bikurim.
You know, a lot of people tell me that how much they want to go to Israel, and they ask if I've gone. I've been there. I'm not going back until Yahweh returns. God can't be found there. That's the furthest place from God right now on the planet. Can't be found there. I think that's going to change. And I hope that we play a role in that. What we've created in these programs and in these books, I hope we contribute to that by accurately conveying the meaning of Yahweh's testimony. But right now, you'd have a tough time finding a more godless place. A place where false gods are more prevalent than Jerusalem and Yehuda. You know, I also think that it's important that we consider Yahudah. Yahud, the basis of it, is simply made feminine. Yahud would be Yahweh's beloved. It's a compound of Yahweh's name and Dod's name. Now, you know, we could talk for days on what that means. That Yahweh's people are a compound of Yahweh's name and Dod's name, the author of the Psalms, the Mizmor. Simply made feminine, because Yahweh's nature is to relate to us in a motherly way. And he is removing the support which upholds life. Well, there's two things that uphold life. What he did on Pesach and what the Spirit does for us on Matzah and Bikurim. The provisions of the shepherd's staff, which would be really Dod.
The leader.
You know, we like to think of, Dod and Moshe. Dod and Moshe are the two shepherds. You know, that Christians want to present Yoshe as a shepherd, or Jesus as a shepherd, but he never tended a single sheep. Not one.
He was a mason.
That's what Dod did, though. That's what Moshe did. So the support of the shepherd's staff is the support that Moshe provides through the Torah that he was inspired to convey to us in the Mizmor and Mishpah, the Proverbs and Psalms that Dod composed as he was inspired by Yahweh. That's the shepherd's staff. All of the bread, matzah, and supplies of water, the source of life, a symbol of the Spirit, a means of cleansing, it's the universal solvent. It's a great deal of insight here, but you got to render the words correctly, right?
Absolutely.
But that's not all that Yahweh was removing. His list of those he will not accommodate. And he specifically lists those that he is removing. He's not just removing the provisions which uphold life, the shepherd's staff, the stores of bread and supplies of water. He's removing the yeast, man's yeast, the powerful politically, Gibor, the mighty, the strong, the militant, the warrior, the soldier, the hero, the prominent leader. He's removing all the powerful people, the political people, the man of war. Oh, you know, all these ads for the U.S. Army, you know, we're looking for warriors.
That was not.
Yeah, he's only looking to get rid of them. The judge. Boy, I really had an interesting experience with, my reckless driving situation. I shared that with the listeners here, all of you, not all that long ago, and you were kind enough to write letters, and, you know, the first judge convicted me on false testimony from the officer, and in appeals it was overturned. And so I'm not guilty of reckless driving. I wasn't guilty of reckless driving, and it's now I'm officially not guilty of reckless driving. But in that process, I was exposed to the false nature of our judicial system. And I had the opportunity last weekend, as I was talking with one of the most famous lawyers in America, someone who's argued many cases before the Supreme Court, men were actually responsible for freeing thousands of people from death row, rightfully from death row. And we were talking about the nature of the judicial system and the officers who play such a role in it. And after all these years of practicing law, the highest level, it is his conclusion that most of the testimony of police officers is false. In fact, he said that one of his best friends who was a police officer for his whole life, when he retired, he said, the single happiest moment of my life, because I no longer have to remember all of my lies. The majority of what they say is untrue. The same thing about the Justice Department. And the judge, he says, all the judges know their line. Other officers know their line. The prosecutors know their line. The judges know their line. The only one that doesn't know their line, the juries. Tens of thousands of people have been falsely convicted based on false testimony in a wholly corrupt system. And he says you'd be staggered by the number of people who have been framed. So I certainly have lost my respect.
There's an ill-informed jury, and lawyers on both sides do everything they can to make sure informed jury members don't get paneled.
Correct. He doesn't want the judge around. He doesn't want the prophet, the one who claims to speak on behalf of God. Now, you might say, wait a minute, Nabi, Yeshayahu was a Nabi. Be careful. I can't condemn those Nabi. Oh, yeah? I'd like to ask you, how many authorized Nabi have there been who have proven that they have spoken the inspired word of Yahweh?
Woody?
In the last 2,500 years.
Oh, well, there's a few after Yeshayahu.
Yeah, well, I said 2,500 years. Just to, yeah, that's, there's Malachi and Zechariah after him, but they're, you know, 2,500 years ago. In the last 2,500 years, you could probably say Yahochanan, although we have trouble with that because the testimony has not been retained.
It's proven, really.
Yeah. You can't prove it. No.
No.
Well, and it wasn't even, you know, the word of God. He was describing visions he was shown, but yeah. But even then, like you said, we don't have any of the original writings, so it's not
right.
Really incredibly useful.
Right. So, you know, and fortunately, most of what he is seeing is presented in Daniel.
Yes.
So we do have a way to verify much of it. So you've got. I don't know if you. I'm at a loss to come up with another.
Count it on one hand.
Yeah, I'm not going to count.
Yosha is quoting.
Yosha as a prophet. It's the mouth of Yahweh, and we don't have anything he said in the original language either. So all these people that claim to have been prophets, oh boy, can you imagine being Paul or Joseph Smith? Man, you are in serious trouble. The one who promises a better future. Oh man, that's every politician and most religious
the new world
leaders.
The great again.
Yeah.
Go back to his father. Go back to George the First, you know, and his thousand points of light and all that sort of good stuff. He's going to promise you everything.
Yeah. Go back to FDR.
Yeah. New Deal.
Mm-hmm. The one who claims to possess hidden knowledge. Adam Weishaupt. He was talking to a friend of mine the other day about conspiracies. And I said, you know, there's only one conspiracy that I know to be true. One meaningful conspiracy that I know to be true. And it goes all the way back to Adam Weishaupt and the creation of political correctness and socialist secular humanism and its pervasive influence throughout society. But even then, it's not one that I'm going to discuss at any length because there's not enough to be gained, and it's this great credibility sinkhole even to pursue it. But that was what he was claiming. Adam Weishaupt claimed to have hidden knowledge. That's what all of the institutions that he created to promote his thirst for power claimed to have hidden knowledge. Look at the Freemasons and all these secret societies. They're the ones that claim signs and wonders. Oh, my, how many signs and wonders were associated with Shaul, the plague of death, Paul, the author of 13 of the Christian New Testament books. The community and religious leader, the elders of society, the establishment, the dignitaries, the officer in command of a military battalion of 50 or more. Not the troops, it's the officers. It's the religious clerics, not the faithful. Especially one who exalts himself. Boy, that would be true of most senior officers and senior clerics in the presence of others. In addition to the counselor, who implies that his advice is valuable, including the shrewd religious practitioner and the one who claims to receive and then imparts spellbinding orations comprised of enchanting superstitions. Oh, and be careful. If you are a Christian or a Muslim, and you say, oh, no, we're in monotheism. We're not talking about spellbinding, enchanting superstitions associated with serpents and seductive, mesmerizing prayers. Guess what? The religions are based upon paganism.
You pick up all the
almost every important aspect. Judaism and Islam and Christianity are pagan, right to their core. It's all demonic. The Jesus of Christianity, the Allah of Islam, the Hashem of Judaism, behind the veil, is Hasatan himself. So God is cleaning house, his house. He's not only withdrawing his support, he is specifically rejecting every political, religious, military, and academic leader. Everyone, from the exalted to the shrewd, from the spellbinding orator to the political pontificator. And he has been consistent in this regard. The societal construct that man has established will be overturned by God. So now, just before we move on, let's contemplate not only how comprehensive God's list of rejected occupations has become, but also consider how different God's perspective is than man's. Those society esteems and praises, adores, Yahweh disdains and despises. The list of ungodly endeavors includes the politically powerful and prominent leader, whether hero or despot, the man of war, including the soldier who wields weapons in battle, the judge who adjudicates or litigates, the preacher or prophet who claims to speak on behalf of a god, the one who promises a better future, claiming to possess hidden knowledge, along with the ability to work wonders, the community religious leader, the officer in command of a military battalion, the one who exalts himself and claims to forgive the failures of others, the counselor who implies that his advice is valuable, the shrewd, the clever, and crafty, the religious cleric promoting pagan myths, and the one who perceives and imparts spellbinding orations replete with enchanting superstitions.
Yeah, we just went through one of those enchanting superstitions a few nights ago.
Yes, we did. Yeah, All Hallows Eve. That is the reincarnation of the Roman pagan celebration at this same time of year. Then I will actually allow, and for a time cause, stammering infants as their leaders and immature, petulant children to exercise authority over them because they are just like them. Now, Yahweh is really clear. He made it really clear in Samuel that by choosing human religious and political leaders, military leaders, mankind is rejecting the Creator himself. To choose the military is to disassociate from God. To choose politics is to disassociate from God. To choose religion is to disassociate from God. And so now God is saying, you know, that's what they chose to do. So he's going to actually allow, and for a time cause, just stammering infants. They are loudmouth, misguided, and shaken adolescents as their leaders, as those in charge of them. And immature and petulant children, vexing, wanting, capricious youth, who are impulsive and ill-tempered, to exercise authority over them because they're just like them. To control them because they're so similar. Continually ruling over them, assimilating with them, and thus coming to represent them. Michelle, the word that we use for proverb or parable. In other words, that this is a word picture, this immature, petulant children and stammering infants is a word picture of what the leaders, religious, political, and military over God's people have become. You know, as I consider the worst of them, people like Rabbi Akiba, Bar Kokhba, Hadrian, and to an extent, even Claudius and Nero. Caligula, even Herod. Yeah. I mean, look at the people. And if you want to look, with the exception of Hezekiah, you know, try to find a decent ruler over in Israel in the time before the Greeks. And of course, there were none after that. Until, well, quite recently, 1948, and you'd have a tough time to find high quality people since then. I think history shows that this has been right. There is no doubt, is there?
No.
Is there anyone other than Hezekiah that would stand out and say, you know, this person was mature, rational, came to know and love Yahweh, ruled in an appropriate way? No, and you know, one of the things that this suggests, we always hear that the people get the government they deserve. Mm-hmm. That's what God is saying here.
Right.
The people in Israel, and particularly in Jerusalem and Yehudah, are going to get the government they deserve. The government, those who are leading them religiously and politically, are just the same as they are. All a bunch of bratty children. You know, I've shared this a number of times before, but I've watched the degradation of human thinking. And I've wondered, you know, is it a product of politics and religion, where people are conditioned not to think? Is it a product of political correctness, where to exercise good judgment, to be discerning and discriminating is considered the greatest sin? Is it simply a product of societal conditioning? Is it the removal of rhetoric from academia, debate, rules of
everything
logic?
Everything I read was the philosophy came first. Experimentalism became, you know, progressive education, which basically was all that in a guise. Not only after it invaded the school systems, and starting on the college level, then it invaded the high school system, which took them a long time to get rid of enough of the older teachers that didn't agree with that. In California, it was law to teach a particular way. If you don't sign an agreement, you couldn't teach on in California university systems. And then I think it invaded the Sunday schools. And so it just, everywhere a person went, they were confronted with the same thing.
Yeah. And it's not limited to the religious.
Societal
indoctrination and the degradation of thinking, the dumbing down of society. Because, you know, America, for example, over the past 50 years, has gone from a preponderance of people who identify themselves with being religious and being Christian to a preponderance that now identify themselves as being secular.
Mm-hmm.
And their ability to think is no better, although they're a bit more egotistical about it, and they claim to be rational, when in fact I'm not sure they can spell the word or explain what it actually means.
Mm-hmm.
And those who are atheists and agnostics get their jollies about poking fun and considering themselves superior to the religious, and their arguments against God are always arguments against religion, not knowing that God himself is opposed to religion.
I'll tell you how strong the secular stuff is now. And I came home and told Terry about an incident. I was down in the studio, and the lady asked me, one of the other owners of businesses, she walked over to me. She said, are you going home to do the for the Halloween for trick or treat? And I said, no. And to make a long story short, I told her, you know, I just don't do pagan things. She immediately shut up. And we're friends. We talk all the time. And she just, as if, oh, that must be a religious thing. This is what Terry surmised, and I think she's absolutely right.
Yeah.
It must be a religious thing, and I do not want to be politically correct, you know. So she just
Halloween has become the second most celebrated.
Oh, yeah.
Holiday in the country. And Christmas is number one. And the majority of people now who are celebrating Christmas and Halloween are not religious.
No.
And they love it. They extol its virtues. And it's fun. I mean, no idea what it represents. Not even caring.
Ignorance is no excuse.
Yeah. So the people shall be oppressed and controlled, individual by individual, mankind by his evil countrymen. The young people will be contentious, defiant, and enraged against authority, especially towards the establishment in positions of authority. And he will bring upon himself and experience pain by being despised and degraded, along with those who are wealthy, honored, and distinguished. Boy, is that ever true.
Mm-hmm.
Throughout time, really. You know, it doesn't matter when these words were written. In fact, back at the time they were written, you know, Israel was oppressed. The Assyrians and then the Babylonians. And after the Babylonians came the Greeks, and after the Greeks the Romans, and after the Romans the Byzantine, and after the Byzantine the Muslims, and now it's the United Nations and socialist secular humanists. So the people shall be oppressed and controlled, individual by individual, mankind by his evil countrymen, a harmful and unprincipled fellow citizens by way of improper oration. Ish bara hu. The young people will be contentious, defiant, enraged. Boy, is that ever true. Habitually arrogant, self-centered, haughty, boisterous, confused, and pretentious. That is an apt depiction of what we witness today, especially towards the establishment.
I have a couple of friends who are 4 or 5 years younger than I am, and in the span of 4 years, somehow they went from being huge supporters of Ron Paul to huge supporters of Bernie Sanders. I'm like, you've got two people that couldn't have more opposite views. But they just
right.
were, man, all you could tell that all they cared about was they just did not want more of the same crap that they've had.
Right.
And so they didn't care whoever was the alternative they wanted. You know, because they were generally, you know, they're upset and confused, and they don't know what they believe. They just know they don't like what's going on.
And the worst possible option is the Bernie Sanders.
Mm-hmm. It is the onslaught of socialist secular humanism. Societal establishment of political correctness and of multiculturalism and of a communist economic system that is so crippled productivity and so crippled good judgment and so crippled character, so crippled the concept of responsibility, of reason. And so Bernie Sanders simply represents that in an even more extreme form. Now, Ron Paul's not a superior option. One time I would have appreciated his libertarian rhetoric because less intrusion by government is better than more intrusion, but of course he is also religious.
Yeah.
Do they read Communist Manifesto or Engels or Marx or any of those things in school anymore?
I don't think so. When I was in school,
I read them, but that was on my own studying. But
right.
It was never required.
I don't think that anyone has done what I did, which is to juxtapose Mein Kampf and the Quran.
Mm-hmm. No.
And I think very few people have done what needs to be done to understand economic schemes, which is to recognize that communism and fascism are both capitalistic in nature. They both use capital, human capital and monetary capital, as well as property to manufacture product. They're both capitalistic systems. What you really have is communism and fascism, which are the same side of, are different sides of the same coin, and free enterprise, which is an entirely different concept. And people don't recognize that in practicality, there is no difference between communism and fascism. That's why Nazi Germany was the German Socialist Workers' Party. A fascist system and a communist system are essentially the same in practice. There was really no tangible, appreciable difference between Stalin's Soviet Republic and Hitler's Third Reich in Nazi Germany.
Yeah.
Both regimes were government-controlled, dictatorial, and the antithesis of free. The only subtle difference is in a communist society, the government owns
everything,
property and businesses. And in a fascist society, the government controls property and businesses. But what's the difference between ownership and control?
Nothing. Ultimately, nothing.
Nothing. If you do not have control, you do not own.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing. But that kind of distinction is something that so few people make, that you've got a bunch of just morons on Antifa, the anti-fascist thugs, who are protesting against the neo-Nazi thugs, the white supremacists, thinking that their arch enemies, as if we've returned to Germany v. Russia in World War II. Where two dictatorial regimes are fighting each other for the glory of the dictator. It's just utterly stupid. It's an affirmation that Yahweh got this one right to do. Then indeed he will grasp hold of a man among his brothers, someone of his father's house. Because of your clothing, you shall be our supreme leader. So let this pile of rubble, which has become a stumbling block, be under your control. a dashing individual. It sounds a lot like Malak Shaul, the king. Yeah, he was tall, dark, and handsome. He had the nicest wardrobe, the shiniest armor, the flashiest sword. He was dashing. And they chose him. And now the people are going to say, all right, we're going to pick the most dashing man among us to be our supreme leader. We're going to reprise the mistake we made 3,000 years ago with Shaul all over again. That's what we're going to do. And this pile of rubble, which Israel is going to become, this mess of twisted mess of religious institutions, let you take control of it, they say. Isn't that what's being said here?
Mm-hmm.
These terms are so interesting, too, this Ha-Meshelah. Hazoth, let this overturned heap of ruins which causes us to trip and stagger into calamity and sorcery be under your control. It's not saying take away this pile of ruins. It's saying let the religion that's caused us to trip stagger. Let the political institutions that have become a stumbling block, let them be under your control. Is it? They're not saying you sweep them away, you do away with them. No. You fix them. It's like the people that say, you know, the solution to Islam is a reformation. No, it's not. Well, the solution to Christianity is not the solution to Islam. And the solution to America is not to make America great again. The solution is to disavow and disassociate from politics and religion. Not to place these stumbling blocks under the control of someone who just looks the part. Kirk, you had mentioned to me that there were words in 3:6 and then in 3:7 that you drilled down on and had some considerable fun with. Do you want me to read the 3:7 and then you share how they...
Yeah, actually it was in 3:8, yeah. But I'll point out the... In 3:6, I was thinking about it. Simla is the part about the clothes, and I was thinking, okay, religious dress-up, or he's the one who's adorned in all the great clothes or what have you. And then I looked at the what it was related to, which is Simel, and I thought, well, this is odd. It's a statue, a figure, an image, and an idol. And I said, well, it must be pointing that to a movie, like a movie idol or a celebrity status or an entertainer or something like that. And then I just didn't even think about it until we got to 3:8. So I don't want to jump the gun too much. But when we get to 3:8, I'll join all that together, and it's really quite interesting what you glean in these little bit of things. And as I said to you, without boring everybody, you look at these little details and things, and there's so many little gems in there, and even in the smallest of details, Yahweh is saying exactly what you just said, or just what you read, and that how much he cannot stand religion, idol worship. Everything is the Lord, worship and prayer, and I could throw it at you right now, or I could wait. I don't want to step on.
Yeah, let's go through
three eight, and then I'll show you.
Yeah, let's go through 3:7 and 3:8, and then let's tie it all together.
Okay.
But in that day of his, he will say, "I will not be dressed up as a remedy in my house. There is neither bread nor any clothing, so you should not make me supreme leader of the people." Isn't it interesting that the person that they are choosing,
mm-hmm,
is, they're saying, no, There's nothing here. There's no clothes. There's no food. I can't be dressed up as a remedy. It doesn't happen very often.
Who do you think he's most talking about? Is this the end times in Jerusalem? When now we have a we have the Torahless one, and he does have a supporter in Israel, one that reinforces him. Is that who he's talking about here, or is that just any politician of that?
I'm not sure what the answer.
More specific than that, or is it just a generalized?
It's clearly, we clearly know that that everything up to this point has materialized exactly as it has was written, and it was true from the time it was written all the way to today. And then there are now aspects of it that are especially true today, particularly the influence on the young people and their lack of reason and their pretentiousness, and so that's the transition we're witnessing today. And we know that he's speaking to Israel, particularly to Yehuda and those in Jerusalem.
Right.
And things are going to get bad. Because now they're speaking of, they realize it's rubble and a stumbling block. Now, I don't think the people, in fact, I know they don't realize that now.
Mm-hmm.
Even though the 80% of Jews who are secular, I don't think look at Judaism as a stumbling block. They just choose not to participate because they're socialist secular humanists.
Mm-hmm.
But it says, seeming to be suggested that the people of Israel and Yehuda are going to be looking for their leader. And, it seems a little bit like what Rabbi Akiva voiced on them, where they turned to Bar Kokhba as the false Messiah. And of course, the people were devastated as a result during the first Roman siege in 70 CE. And that set them up for Hadrian in 133, when I guess that was the time of Rabbi Akiva, was in 133, the total annihilation of Israel. And, Rabbi Akiva was the highest rated, most honored, most highly regarded rabbi. He would have been the man in the finest clothes. And Bar Kokhba was certainly dashing. He was the richest of the warlords, which is why he was chosen. And that wasn't very long lived, particularly if you look at Bar Kokhba's role. That was, we know he was chosen, and we don't know much more about him after that. He was promoted by Akiva, and then what do we know about him, really?
It was a short life after that.
Yeah. So is there a hint of that, perhaps?
No.
Is there a hint of whoever's going to follow Netanyahu here?
Well, we're so short on time, and we're getting closer and closer to 26 and 28. I think so. I couldn't tell you who, but...
This individual, I spoke of in Yashigah 3-7, is not being selected out of obscurity. The individual knows the nation's problems are too severe to be resolved. So he's not like Trump.
Right.
He's not going to say, make Israel great again.
No.
He realizes that in such dire circumstances, he cannot even provide the staples of mortal life, food, water, shelter, and clothing. So I think it is last days. With the death lurking all around them, the surviving Israelites will once again be searching for their HaMashiach. And also, this is, in all likelihood, a modern-day variation of Bar Kokhba.
Mm-hmm.
But this time there will be no Rabbi Akiva, no Shimon Bar Kokhba. By the way, his name was Shimon Bar Hasawa, based upon the evidence that has now been unearthed in the cave of letters. He was the son of a star and thus considered to be divine.
Wow.
Man is not the answer. Yahweh alone can resolve what ails humankind. There will be no hope of MAGA.
What is MAGA?
Make America Great Again.
Oh, my God.
MAGA.
Of course. Keep up, Kirk. Okay.
Yeah, there you go. For indeed, Yerushalem has stumbled and for a time faltered, and Yehuda has fallen because of their slanderous language and their actions against Yahweh, especially with regard to rebelling bitterly against and defying the manifestation of his power and presence. It's interesting here. Tell us that this, it's difficult for us to say, to identify who this individual is. And 3-7, because throughout history, we've not encountered an individual such as this. You know, those who are prominent and successful usually have the ego of saying, give me the job, I'll get it done. Yeah, and this is a guy who's obviously successful and well-known and dashing, and yet he's saying, I don't want the job. Too far gone. I can't do this. No one can do it. We've not met that individual at this time. But there's going to be someone like that. And this individual may or may not know that the answer is Yahweh and that the problem is rejecting him. And that's what God is saying in 3:8. And when you have that individual mentioned, you've got to realize that the next statement has to be related to it, and therefore this individual is likely to know what the reason that it can't be resolved, the problems can't be resolved. And it kind of draws your attention to, you know, the two witnesses. I don't expect them to be dressed in a $3,000 suit. But they're representing Yahweh. They're not going to be grubby. No, have been spiritual and less energy-based individuals for a very long time. They're going to be magnificent looking. And even they know the answer. They're going to be dashing. They're going to be in Israel. They're going to be in Jerusalem. They're going to be stunningly beautiful, representing Yahweh and his word. And the people turn to them and say, all right, you clear away the muck, and which is not what this is saying. This is, you take control.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to say, no, we're not taking control. You know, if we were asked, which it would never be, to run the government, we'd say no.
No, walk away from
it. There's nothing to save. I'm not going to do that because not only is there nothing to save, even if you could save it, it isn't worth saving. It's worthless. Its overall value is negative. It's a net negative, not a net positive, even when it's at its best. And so, you know, it could well be that we're talking about Eliyahu, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because we certainly, this individual is unlike anybody else that we have encountered along life's way. In talking about us, that's for darn sure, because, you know, I go around in shorts and flip-flops. And no one can say, man, that guy, he is dapper. And I don't know how you guys dress, but they're not going to mistake us. But beyond all that, it says, from among their brothers. You know, we aren't Yahudim. So it's sure as heck in us. And they're going to turn down the job. Good for them. For indeed, Jerusalem has stumbled and for a time faltered, has staggered, and Yahuda has fallen, has gone from a higher position to a lower one, has fallen prostrate in a fall, and therefore is neglected. They have lost their perspective in place, in a relationship and situation. Why? Because of their slanderous language. The Talmud.
Mm-hmm.
Israeli politics. All of it. Why? Because of their slanderous language, of their speech, their tongue, that which they have consumed, the slander. And if you look at the Talmud, it's arguments against the Torah.
Whoa.
If you look at Rabbi Akiva, it was ways that man, religious man, could usurp authority from God. You look at Roman Catholicism.
Exactly.
It's a human institution taking control of access to God. What could be more slanderous? A pope that says he represents God? A rabbi that says, you as a normal individual have no chance of understanding the Torah, so listen to our teachings on the Talmud. There's slanderous language that has got man in so much trouble, as well as their actions, the things that they do, their endeavors and practices, all of which have been against, directed in opposition to. Yeah. It's interesting here that the Masoretic made a very significant change. The Dead Sea Scrolls in 1Q Yeshayah reads M against, directed and in opposition to. The Masoretic text reads L, towards.
Towards, huh.
Especially with regard to rebelling bitterly against and defying. Now, rebellion is a societal thing. When people are described as in abject hostility, contentious, rebellious, recalcitrant, embittered, provocative, we're talking about the influence of religion and politics in opposition to God. And they're doing all of these things, bitterly defying his kibud on who? His manifestation of power in his presence. So where is Yahweh present today? Where is Yahweh going to be present circa 2029 through 2033 in Jerusalem?
His Torah.
His Torah.
Yeah, that's all.
And what is the Talmud?
It may God.
The Talmud's religious arguments against the Torah?
Mm-hmm.
Now, that could be one of those places where the rabbis would say, toward the Torah, as opposed to against the Torah. But the things I've read, it's man's interpretations and twisted applications of what God had to say. They're doing exactly the opposite of what we're doing. What we're doing is, let's try to understand what the words mean. Let's review it all in the context of what Yahweh has conveyed in his teaching and his prophetic revelation. And let's come to understand the implications of each of these things from Yahweh's perspective in a manner that is wholly consistent with his teaching and direction. And they're trying to interpret everything to their favorite. And one of the great examples is on the dietary laws. Yahweh doesn't have any dietary laws.
No.
God never says, you can't eat pork. Never says that. Matter of fact, all he says is, these things are food. I mean, they're healthy. Good for you. These things are not food. Doesn't say you can't eat them. He just says, they're not food. They're not nourishing. And then he says, later in the same Torah, he says, it doesn't matter what you eat, so long as you're thoughtful about it. And yet, what the rabbis have said in their Torah is that the reason that their Talmud is required, indeed necessary, is because God never explained how to obey the rules, the laws regarding food and the Shabbat.
Yeah.
So the Torah is required to explain how to obey those laws. Well, there's a reason that God doesn't tell us how to obey them. Because they're not laws.
They're not supposed to be obeyed.
That's correct.
That was not their
purpose. And they can't figure that out, but they've used that twisted interpretation to give credence to their arguments against Yahweh, to their slander. Is that God didn't explain this, so we have to. You know, to the feeble of mind, that might seem persuasive. It's their number one argument on behalf of the Talmud. God didn't explain the dietary laws. He didn't explain how to observe the Talmud. Therefore, the Torah and the Mishnah are required. And the thoughtless religious buffoon, the faithful, slurps it up. Instead of saying, wait a minute. You want to tell me that the creator of the universe is such a feeble communicator that he forgot to tell us how to do something that he wants us to do? How is that possible? They're not willing to take a moment and to think that, well, if it's what they're saying is true, that he didn't tell us how to obey laws regarding what we should eat and what we should do on the Shabbat, then maybe they aren't laws after all.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe there's a reason. Maybe there's something more important than obedience. Maybe there's no Hebrew word for obedience, and maybe there's a Hebrew word for observance instead. And maybe to observe means something entirely different. Maybe there's something really profound here.
Mm-hmm.
You're a secular Jew. I would encourage you to pursue what is so profound here. This is an extraordinarily important moment, where Yahweh says that the people have faltered, and they have fallen, and they have stumbled because of their slanderous language against Yahweh. What could be more slanderous than replacing Yahweh's name 7,000 times in his Torah and prophets and Psalms with Satan's title, the Lord?
No, nothing.
What could be more slanderous?
That's number one.
What could be more slanderous to say that God is such a poor communicator that if you're an ordinary person, you can't understand him? What could be more slanderous than saying that people have been authorized to speak for him when that isn't the case at all, when they're actually speaking against him? What, if we may move away from Israel for a moment.
Mm-hmm.
What's more slanderous than the Israelite that wrote the Christian New Testament with saying, but I, Paul, say. What could be more slanderous than Paul's 13 letters? All against Yahweh. Bitterly against Yahweh. Defined, disrespectfully. Agonizing hostility. Contentious and obstinate. Rebellious, indeed, against his manifestation of power and presence. Paul was anti-Yosha. The rabbis. Anti-Yosha. So, Yahweh's manifestation of power, they're slanderous of and in opposition to.
Yeah. Well, they even claim that they fulfilled the stuff he couldn't do, like Paul said.
Mm-hmm.
And the rabbis, you know, what would you do with the Torah if you didn't have the Talmud?
Yes.
I mean, he dictates it all to Moshe for 40 days. He writes it, the key outline, in two tablets of stone. And this, you need something more? Dode didn't need any more.
No. We don't need any more.
No, we don't need any more.
So, Kirk, what did you find as you amplified these words?
Well, I was going through each word, and we got to 3:8, and there's Nafal. And, of course, it means to fall down, to getting ready to bow down. So I went from there to, where is it from? It's Palal, which is my old friend, Palal, which is to bow down, to intercede, or primarily it's translated constantly as to pray. And I'm not one of those who believes that Yahweh ever asked you to pray. I can't find any record of it, especially if you're using Palal. So I started thinking about bowing down and praying to idols, because he had mentioned it earlier. And then if you remember, we had some smell in the 3:6 that was translated as idol. So I said, well, maybe I better look at an idol. And so I looked up idol, and I came up with 6 words. And the thing that's most interesting to me about this was, in all these little details, there's some things that basically tell you what Yah equates with how he equates prayer and worship and idols and people called Baal. So I looked through 6 words, and Samael we just talked about, and Pethel was another one, which just simply means a carved image, a graven image, from thal, to cut or to sculpt into shapes. Another word that's translated as idol. Then you have Otseb, O-O-T-S-E-B, O-T-S-E-B, phonetically, which is the way of idolatry, and it also means the pain of idolatry, mortal pain, as well as a way of sorrow. That's the path you go down when you become idolatry, when you go the way of idolatry. And it also means the idols associated with being in great trouble and pain. Itzib, which is spelled exactly the same way, is pain, hurt, and toil. The bread that you receive, which is interesting, we were just talking about bread, that you receive is through great toil and travail and akin to childbirth. Another word related, also translated most times as idols, is etzab, A-T-S-A-B, and it's related to displeasure, grief, hurt, sorrow, and it also means to worship. So we've got, so far, idols, we've got worship, all negative connotations, and you have prayer as a negative connotation. The 6th word was galul, which means idols, and it's just logs, blocks, or shapeless things, but it comes from galal. And what's interesting there is that it means to roll down, to roll away, to wall you off, to remove you. And then I looked up how it was used in Yirmiyah 1:25, which means to roll you down from the rocks, when he was speaking about Babylon. So, if you're involved with Baal, idols, if you're praying to them, I've been to Italy from the northern part all the way to Rome, and there's 1,000 little candles everywhere you go with somebody praying to them and with a statue in front of them. If you're into God on a stick, yes. You so have to put. And worshiping, We go into the worship service on Sunday, the day of the sun god, and you believe you have to pray instead of read what he has to say, you can talk to God, but you'd probably be better off if you hush for a while and listen to what he has to say. Everything in that whole group of words, no matter what I did, I'm in old lettering, the old ancient Hebrew letter, all comes out to these are things that he has a total negative connotation to and says don't associate with. I know it's a little bitty thing, but it reinforces when I find these little things to me, personally, it's just these things reinforce everything that we talk about all the time.
It's not a little thing, Kirk, because understanding, which is the thing that is so vastly superior to knowing, or to believing, and even to knowing, and there's nothing more important than understanding. The means to understanding is through associating in the proper way details. When you find the common ground between the details, when you find the connection between details, which is what you've done, that's the very thing that enables understanding. That's the way we transition from knowing to understanding. You know, knowing is powerful. And you had to come to know to do this study.
Oh, yeah.
But then you made the connections and all these words are related. That's what leads to understanding. It's not a small thing. It's the biggest thing of all.
Well, it certainly helps me. I mean, sometimes I think I'm kind of out on a limb somewhere.
Well, welcome to my world. Because, you know, for the first 15 years I did this, I was out on the law. I was a choker out on the on a very, very, very big limb. And every one of these concepts was the only person on the planet that was advocating these translations of these words and the insights derived from them. I mean, completely alone, no one else on the planet. That's really out on a limb, isn't it? Now, fortunately, it turned out to be the right limb.
Yeah.
And the good thing is that when you're out on this limb and you're pointing what you're finding to other branches on this limb, and they also find, these things are not only true, they're easily affirmed.
Yeah.
And not only are they verifiable, in the process of verifying them, in the process of examining them, that you can go beyond where I was. Doesn't take you away from those conclusions, but does exactly the opposite. It not only reinforces them, builds upon them. And that which you experience, that's not the little thing, Rick. That's the biggest thing of all.
Well, I agree. Yeah, you're right. You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right.
But I think the joy that JB, who is not feeling all that well this evening, he was sick last week. We heard him cough at the beginning of the show, and he may have gone off because everyone in his family has been sick. But when JB went from listening and reading to translating and writing, his goal was simply to translate. He wanted to translate the beginning in Barishith and seeing how far he could go. And because everybody was asking, why don't you just translate more and write less in terms of your interpretations and give us a Torah to read that's properly translated? I said, I can't. I just can't.
Yeah.
Because it's relating the details that is so profound. It's the essence of what we're doing. And JB, I think I heard your voice there. What you found is you couldn't either. And it's not just that
the more you get into it,
the great joy was in sharing what you learned, making the connections.
Mm-hmm.
That's the big part, the most important part of the whole process, is making the connections that lead from knowing to understanding. And that doesn't dismiss the thrill there is in knowing. Boy, the first time you come to know what these words mean and to know what the sentences convey, wow, extraordinarily exciting. But it doesn't even compare to then making the connections that lead to understanding, and that's what you've done with the most recent.
I don't know about you, but when I'm when I'm writing the commentary, I tend to be modifying my translation as I go because I'm learning. As I'm trying to explain it, you know, in writing, what I'm learning, you know, one, I learn more, but two, I start noticing little things. I'm like, oh, you know what? This would actually be a better way to render this. And so by the time I'm done writing the commentary, I've completely reworked the entire translation most of the time.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, both of y'all have said recently that when you take a word, you write down or you put together everything that it can possibly mean, whereas maybe before you might just choose the few English words that are specific to that that particular verse that you're doing. And I agree with y'all now, but I write down everything now. It's getting quite everything I can think of going at from every different angle. And otherwise, you don't find a little thing like a little word at the very tail end where it says idle.
Mm-hmm.
And I say, well, what? You know, and then you go play with idle and you say, what does that mean? And
yeah.
I mean, if, you know, I'm taking my advice from both of y'all by doing that.
Sure.
I just I write it all down and just say, okay, well, let's make sure we're not leaving anything on the table. Of course, we do.
Yeah, well, it's like what JP did in the program. We're talking about this extraordinarily important word of idle.
Mm-hmm.
And well, you took the time to look it up. You found out exactly what idle means based upon the word upon which it was based.
Yeah, I could have just trusted you. I mean, you're already right, and you're right. I mean, you did it all correctly, but it's really gratifying to go up and say, oh, go here, and it all. And what I can't grasp is why so few people can't get it, or why somebody, you know, that doesn't translate.
No desire.
It must be.
Doing things and not thinking about them.
Yeah.
Not caring, just life has enough challenges for them. They don't want to invest the time or the energy, the effort.
Yeah.
To know. It takes time, it takes energy, it takes the want to. More than anything else, it takes the want to.
I agree.
And know do you think the political person, the patriotic person, the religious person has the want to learn something? It completely destroys the credibility of their religion, their politics, their patriotism, and in fact, rather than praising it and affirming it, condemns it and rebukes it.
Yeah, well,
where's the want to?
Yeah. But Terry and I must be praised the way we embraced it and could put it down. You know, when you yada yada book the first time, it was like, wow.
That's one thing that we all have in common, and it's one thing that's really necessary to have a relationship with Yahweh.
Yes.
If you don't have that desire, eternity is going to be miserable for you.
That's true.
That's the same with all of us, is we had the want to.
Mm-hmm.
And Yahweh provided what we needed.
And the rewards are great.
It was there for us. So long as we were willing to invest the time and the energy to find it, so long as we were open-minded and rational, it was there. We just had to have the want to. Well, I want to say good night tonight. It's been a pleasure sharing this with you. I look forward to making our way all the way through this second volume of Yashayav. Finally gotten back to translating. It's been an interesting 6 months for me, but my feet are finally back on the ground. I'm back to translating and writing. I'm looking forward to catching back up on emails. I'm way, way behind, so if you've written me here in the last few months and I haven't responded, it's just strictly that, you know, my world has been a bit sideways here, but I'm getting more grounded with each day. And just in terms of what I'm able to do independently, I'm back with all of my tools in the right situation, the right place. As I say, I'm back translating and commenting, and hope to have a new chapter available and to conclude the second volume of Observations for Our Time. And I made a promise to our good friend Jerry McLaughlin that I'll begin working on a screenplay thereafter. That might help popularize Yahweh's message, at least convey it to those who are receptive, such that they are willing to read and to listen. And Jerry is also, I think, just recently booked on a very significant radio program that he claims now has one of the very largest audiences, if not the largest audience today. So we'll continue to share what we have learned and allow those who are interested and who have the want to come verify for themselves and to consider how vastly different God is from the pagan representation that man has been wont to promote, and how vastly superior the actual God, Yahweh, is in every possible way.
Indeed.
So thank you, fellas. We'll be back together with you next week.
Enjoy it. Shalom, shalom to both of you.
Good night.
Bye.
Bye.